Good morning. We are continuing our survey of the New Testament, and we're going rather quickly, grouping some topics together. Last week we talked about Jesus' parables, and this morning we're going to focus on his miracles and one lesson, try to look at several aspects of his miracles. I'd like to begin by asking you, what is a miracle? What is it according to the definition that the Bible would give? Is this an example of a miracle, Karen, when Jeff puts away his dirty laundry? Is that a miracle?
No, it's not.
Okay. It's just amazing. Just amazing. All right, I got a hand back here. I got an enthusiastic hand. Oh, you're agreeing. Okay. Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. What do people call a miracle? The miracle of childbirth. Is that a miracle in the sense of what Jesus did? So why do we call it the miracle of childbirth? Because it is amazing. It is absolutely remarkable. What is a miracle then? It's supernatural. You've got the natural world. You've got the natural order of things. And when that is superseded, we say that is miraculous. What miracles occur today in the modern world? We're quick to say, well, no, they don't in the way that they did in biblical times. Who's walking on water? Who's turning a little bit of food into enough to feed thousands? So we understand that miracles as they occurred in the Bible don't today. Think about this. When did miracles just happen all the time in biblical history?
They had a purpose.
We're going to talk about that a little bit. But when were miracles happening in biblical history? Okay, but isn't God always at work with his children? There are special times, though. Moses, I'll get us started. Moses, the miracles he performed, or God performed through him, of course. The 10 plagues, were those miraculous? It's always interesting when you see explanations. I've seen Time Magazine and other National Geographic. They're trying to explain some of the miracles in a naturalistic way. Well, all those locusts, they descended on Egypt because of a wind or something. Yeah, that's what the Bible actually says. But the Bible presents it as being supernatural, that God did this. When you take the supernatural out of God's Word, does it hurt the credibility of the Bible? Are these simply natural events that are being described supernaturally? Do we, as Christians, believe in the virgin birth of Jesus? Is that natural? That in and of itself is supernatural. All right, we understand that there were periods of times when miracles were more active, like in the days of Moses. Elijah, Elisha, they performed miracles. John the Baptist, did he perform miracles? No, he did not. And Jesus did. Who else after Jesus performed miracles? The apostles. And Paul expresses the idea that the miracles, the miraculous activity, will cease after we have the inspiration of the Bible, the New Testament completed, is how I would understand 1 Corinthians 13 to be what Paul is describing. That which is perfect has come. Maybe that's not what he's talking about, but it certainly seems to be a possibility. Well, let me ask you this question. A, B, C, or D, why did Jesus perform miracles? What was the purpose of them? And I've got some options up here for us to think about. Did Jesus perform miracles to help people? Sure, of course. To fulfill prophecy? Were there prophecies about the Messiah performing miracles? As a matter of fact, there were. Do you think C is probably the primary reason? Jesus performed miracles to prove to people, hey, I'm claiming to be the Messiah, let me demonstrate this. Now, the apostles, didn't they perform miracles? Were they claiming to be the Messiah, though? So why do they perform miracles? In the name of Jesus. Saying we have been sent by Jesus and authorized by Jesus. We're continuing his ministry. In fact, that's something unique about Jesus and his ministry. The disciples that he had imitated him in every way. They didn't just spend time with the master and go back to work. They actually dedicated themselves. That was unusual. But then they began to do all the things Jesus did, including casting out demons and performing miracles and all the teaching and preaching. What was Jesus doing in that 3-year period working with those men? He was getting them ready. He was preparing them for when he would no longer be with them and they would continue his ministry. So the Gospels are about Jesus' ministry. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. What is the book of Acts about? The ministry of the apostles. And of course, the Holy Spirit is the one who is aiding them. That's specifically addressed at the end of Luke's Gospel. Well, all four Gospels, I guess. But then in the opening chapters of Acts. And throughout the book of Acts, you have the Holy Spirit working with the apostles. Yes, sir?
John chapter 20, verse 30, kind of gives the answer about why John.
Okay. Hold that thought. We'll get right to it. All right. To help people. Does Jesus help people? I've just got a few verses I want to show you. Sometimes people might say, well, he didn't do it to help people because he was too busy trying to show people he's the Messiah. Here is an interesting miracle where Jesus raises a young man from the dead and information is given to us. It's Nain, N-A-I-N, N-A-I-N, in Galilee during his Galilean ministry. And he sees a woman who's a widow. This is her only son. So what does that tell you? If she's bearing her only son and she's a widow. She has no livelihood. She is destitute here. And Jesus stops the funeral procession and he tells the woman, do not weep. He is filled with compassion. He touches the bier of the coffin that the boy is in and he raises him from the dead. So did this prove to people who were there, hey, this is the Messiah? Sure. But when I look at this little miracle, it seems to me Jesus is reaching out to help her. Now, were there other dead people in Galilee in the time of Jesus? Did he raise them all from the dead? No. That's something for us also to think about. Going on in Luke's Gospel, in another place, it talks about how Jesus is fulfilling prophecy from Isaiah 35, for example. The Messiah is going to help. He's going to enable the blind to receive their sight, the lame to walk, lepers are going to be cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up. Did Jesus leave out any of that? He did all those miracles, didn't he? Now look at that last part of Jesus' quote. The poor have the gospel preached to them. We should never lose sight of the ultimate purpose of the miracles, and that is to confirm what Jesus was claiming. I am the Christ. I am the Messiah. So A and B are true. And C, here it is. Here's John 20, 30 and 31. What were you saying there? Jeff, go and read these verses for us, if you would. All right. So what do those verses tell us? What were you going to say before I rudely interrupted you? Okay. John, and we're going to talk about this, John records 7 signs, as he calls them. 7 signs. Were there others that Jesus performed besides the 7 that John records? Sure. How many of these miracles have you personally witnessed? Did you see Jesus turn water to wine? I know Ricardo's old, but I don't think you were alive back then. What is John's point then when he says these have been written that you might believe? And he knows you haven't seen them. And this isn't hearsay. I heard about somebody who heard from somebody else. No, John is saying This is eyewitness testimony. I'm telling you what happened. And that's important. We believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. We don't know all the situation. We didn't know Mary and Joseph personally, but we believe that is how it happened. Yes, sir. Yeah, we actually saw Jesus. We handled him. We touched him. He wasn't an apparition or something like that. Perhaps combating the Gnostics in the first century. And 1 John 1 and verse 1. I clicked. I accidentally clicked. I guess my PowerPoint's saying, Mark, you need to move on. All right, what about this one? D, did Jesus perform miracles to benefit himself? No. Well, that was one of the reasons I had on the screen. All right, let's think about this passage. Luke 4, when Jesus has not eaten for 40 days. He's in the wilderness, and he was hungry. Thanks, Luke. Yeah, Captain Obvious there. Jesus was hungry, and the devil says, if you are the Son of God, command this stone to become bread. And Jesus said, that's a great idea. That could benefit me personally. I have the power. I can do it. So what did Jesus say in response instead? It is written, man shall live by bread alone. I'm not going to do it. So D is canceled out. Jesus did not perform miracles, it seems, simply to benefit himself. It wasn't zap, I can do this. Zap, I can do that. There are apocryphal gospels. You know, inquiring minds want to know, what was Jesus like as a child? What was his life like from the time he was 12 years old to 30? We don't know about that 18-year gap. And there are apocryphal gospels that tell us about a mischievous Jesus who would play tricks on his friends. And he would turn birds into stone. Zap. That's not in the Bible. And these are silly little stories about Jesus. He did not use his miraculous abilities, it seems, until after his baptism anyway. Yes, ma'am. For personal benefit? Okay. So in Luke 4, when Jesus says, I am the Messiah, or well, he doesn't say it in so many words, but the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing, he makes the people very angry, his hometown in Nazareth. And what the text says, let me go back to it here, they wanted to take Jesus and throw him off a cliff. And this is very early in his ministry. Verse 29 of Luke 24, they rose up and drove him out of the town, brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so that they could throw him down the cliff. Luke 4 verse 30 says, but passing through their midst, he went away. And that's it. Okay. Is that a miracle though? I mean, what happened exactly? Let's get Jesus. We're mad at him. Let's throw him off the cliff. Where'd he go? It certainly seems miraculous to me. So, I think that's an interesting point. Yes, sir. I see a hand back here. Okay. In Acts 8, Simon the sorcerer wanted the ability to pass on spiritual gifts. He wanted to be able to show off or do it for money, and he offered money. That's interesting, and he was sharply rebuked for that. That's not what the miracles are for. All right, if we're going to talk about the miracles of Jesus, it would be good for us to remember that in the Gospel of John, there are seven signs, and they lead us up to John 20, which is basically the thesis of the book. These signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, he did to help prove that he is the Christ. And as we're trying to understand what, not just, we're not talking today about what the miracles are, but why. Why did Jesus perform these miracles at all? And what do the record about the miracles teach us? Is it simply to go, oh wow, that's neat. That's really powerful. Or is there sometimes a lot more to it? So in John 2, we're going to go a little quickly because I'm trusting most of us are already familiar with these parables anyway, with these parables, these miracles. John 2 verses 1 through 11 tell us about the first miracle Jesus, the first sign recorded in John's gospel. And you were saying it wasn't his time yet. Well, Jesus is telling mom, hey, it's not my time. I'm not ready to start letting folks know about me. And it's rather curious that his mother prods him to do this, and he accepts the prodding. But you've got these stone water jars. John 2 verse 6 says there were six stone water jars there for Jewish rites of purification. And the ESV helpfully translates what's literally said here to tell us they would hold about 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus is going to take water. These are going to be filled. We're not sure exactly how many gallons were in them. But if there's six and they at a minimum hold 20, that's 120 gallons. And if there's six of them and they hold a maximum of 30 gallons, that's 180 gallons of water turned into wine. Instantaneously. And I wanted to look at what verse 11 says. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Who even knew about the changing of water to wine? Who actually, it's a wedding and people are being refreshed by the wine. They don't want to be drinking just plain old water. They're drinking wine. Most guests had no idea that they had even run out of wine. Who knew about it? Okay, the hosts. The host, it indicates, doesn't even know the source. All he knows is, what does the maitre d' say about the wine? Verse 10. He said, hey, this is unusual. And here's what's so unusual about your wine. It tastes so good. Everyone serves the good wine first at a wedding. Because weddings weren't just one day or 2 days. They went on for a week. That this is a big, big event. And they ran out of wine. And he says, everyone serves the good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine just gets watered down and gets less and less quality. But you have saved the best for last. Oh, that's nice. That Jesus made some good quality wine. That's great. Is there more to this miracle than just simply helping a nice Jewish family out of a humiliating situation? Why are we told that these water jars were used for the Jewish purification rites? Why are there six water jars? Is that just, oh, there just happened to be six, and I think that's true, but why are we told there are six? Why didn't you say there are a few or something like that? Can we sometimes maybe look for information that really we're overstating it, we're overlooking? What is so special about this miracle, turning water to wine? It represents what is to come, what has come indeed in Jesus. All right. The best has come. The best is yet to come. Well, it has come in Jesus. What did the religious leaders have to offer? They offered the stale teachings. They had taken God's covenant, the teaching, the Torah. It's just bland water. Here's a verse, and I shared with this with you when we studied before. It's near the end of Amos. Amos 9 verse 13. There's only 15 verses in that closing chapter. Amos 9 verse 13 says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper. There's just going to be so much produce. This is going to be enormous. the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. You're just going to have an incredibly bumper crop when it comes to your grain and your grapes. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with it. A characteristic of the Messianic age, according to Amos 9, verse 13, is an overflow, an overabundance of wine, sweet wine. Is that something, perhaps, that John expects us to remember and to think, huh, I remember this passage from Amos 9, near the end of it, where Amos is talking about the Messiah. He's talking about the age of the Messiah. And because we're not as familiar with Amos, we may not realize that's there. Water jar, John 2. Water jar. That word does not occur very often in the Gospel of John. In fact, it only occurs in one other passage. Where did somebody have a water jar? The woman at the well in John 4. We're focused on John 2, 1 through 11. And we see that Jesus is inaugurating the age of the Messiah. People are seeing the glory of the Messiah. Just as the preface to John's Gospel said, we beheld His glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John 2, verse 11. The very next chapter says people saw His glory when He turned water to wine. And then in John 3, you've got Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews, and he is interacting with Jesus, and does Jesus tell him, Nicodemus, let me tell you something, I am the Messiah. This important Jewish leader, does he tell Nicodemus that important information? He does not. Who does he tell then in John 4? Some important individual? Let me tell you, lady, I'm the Messiah. Some lowly woman. No, not just a woman. How lowly was she in the eyes of the Jews? A Samaritan woman. And here's Jesus revealing to her, I'm the Messiah. And she had a water jar. Does John intend for us to be reading our Gospel of John, John 1, John 2, John 3, John 4? We come to John 4 and he starts talking about a water jar. And he never mentions water jars again. Are we meant to go, is there maybe a connection between John 2 and John 4? We don't talk about that a whole lot, but is the miracle itself important? And then it's expanded, its significance is expanded as we go on. Well, what's in the water jar is just water. But what did Jesus tell the woman, I can give you? Living water. Water that gives life. That's exactly right. All right, here's something else. I'm just going to throw this out to you. Please don't disfellowship from me. There were 6 stone water jars. I don't know if this is significant or not. I don't know. I'm still grappling with this. Is 6 a really special number in the Bible? No. What about the next number? 7. We're not told there were 7 water jars. There were 6. And then Jesus comes. And he gives wine. He turns the water into wine. With that woman in John 4, how many husbands did she have? How many men in her life did she have total? 6. Now she's got a new man in her life. Number 7. What do you think? You're going, I don't think so. I don't think so. But we've got a connection here. We've got incompletion, 5, you know, and you've got 5 husbands, had 5 husbands. The man that you have now is not your husband. That'd be number 6. And then now she's got Jesus in her life, number 7. And she has the stone water jar. Sir?
The 7.
I'm still thinking about that. So don't get too mad at me. I think these miracles are great in and of themselves, but I wonder sometimes if they're meant to be seen in light of the whole book and see that there's more to what's going on even in John 2 and to expand our minds and to think about their significance. Yes.
Well, we know that Jesus spoke in parables. Sometimes the parables were a little bit different to understand. Unless you thought about them, they got fixed.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. These are pictorial parables. He's teaching about spiritual truths, is he not? But he's doing it in quite a remarkable way. So yes, he's proving he's the Messiah. But there's some spiritual significance behind these miracles. And that's what I do want to convey. I've studied this passage with you. It's one of my favorite. John 4, the closing verses of John 4 record the second sign. I just left John 2. In verse 12, it says, no, it doesn't. Verse 11 says, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee. In John 4, verse 54, it says, this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. And John stops counting after that point, but he identifies the first two signs very clearly for us. This one is one of my favorite. We're not going to read it. I'm just going to remind you of what's going on here. Jesus heals a nobleman's son who is deathly sick. There's about a 12-15 minute distance along the path between Cana and Capernaum. That's what's so amazing about this miracle. You see in verse 46 that Jesus is in Cana. Where's the sick boy? Not in Cana, but in Capernaum. And what is the man asking Jesus to do? He comes to Cana and he says, Jesus, I need you to go back with me to Capernaum and heal my son. And Jesus basically says to him, no, I'm not going to do that. Now for us to travel 12-15 miles, is that a big deal? You hop in your car and zoom on. What about in the first century world? That would be more of an ordeal. And Jesus normally would be willing to do that. Is Jesus just being cantankerous here? Is he just being unkind? You got your problem, I got my problem. I'm not coming. There's more to it, isn't there? And I like to emphasize how in three places you have the verb believe used. Where in verse 48, Jesus, when the man says, I need you to come back and heal my son, and Jesus says, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And I hope you have a footnote in verse 48 that tells you the you is not singular. Jesus is not saying to this nobleman, this dad, unless you personally, sir, believe or see signs, you will not believe. He's talking about people in general. They just want to see signs. They just got to see signs. And the man says, I'm desperate. I need you to come back and heal my son. So the first mention of belief is how people will not believe unless they see a sign. And then Jesus says in verse 49, go, your son lives. You just go on home. When you go back home, your son will be just fine. And then the text says the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him. At that point, what choice did the man have? Jesus made it obvious. I am not going back with you. I like how the NIV paraphrases this. He took Jesus at his word. But what it literally says is he believed the word that Jesus spoke to him. Verse 53 tells us that when the dad gets back, or actually his servants are meeting him on the way, and they say, great news! Your son's fine! The fever's gone! And the dad, you can imagine, he's so relieved. But he says, let me ask you, when did the fever leave him? Yesterday, about the seventh hour. You know, they didn't have exact timepieces like we do. About the seventh hour. That was the exact time when Jesus said, your son lives. The father knew that was the hour when Jesus said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed. No, wait a minute. It just said in verse 50 that the dad believed, and then it says again in verse 53, the dad believed. Why does it say it twice? Wasn't one enough? okay. The first time, he had no choice. He had to believe. The second time, he truly believes. Okay, he could have just given up and gone home, but he chose to hope for the best. Okay. So what impact does this miracle have on us? John has written this so that we might believe that Jesus is Christ, the Son of God. What impact does this miracle have on us? It builds our faith up. And faith and belief are the same idea, same concept. Are there times in your life when it's hard for you to believe? To trust? And he's saying, go. It's going to be okay. Right, when he starts telling them, you're not going to believe what happened. Well, now we do believe. These miracles weren't just simply to help a poor boy who was sick. It was to help people spiritually. And isn't that true of all the miracles? In more ways than some, I suppose. John 5, the third sign, even though it's not identified that way, it was at the pool of Bethesda, as it's called. There's a man who has been sick for 38 years. That's verse 5. And this is a model of the pool. There are five porticos, five porches. This is a real place, so archaeologically we're interested in it. And a few years ago it was discovered. And this is the actual site of the pools there on the screen. But Jesus heals this person, and there's an element here that's really important. And again, we're trying to survey, but it wasn't simply that Jesus healed a man who was an invalid who couldn't walk. It's several verses in, but after the man is healed, then we are told this: the day Jesus healed him, it was the Sabbath. And that opens a whole new can of worms. Why? Oh, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And when Jesus healed the man, he took up his bed and he walked home. And that's not good. Can you imagine how demented do you have to be? How antagonistic, unrealistically antagonistic do you have to be so angry with Jesus because he healed somebody on the Sabbath? Who couldn't walk for 38 years. What's involved in healing somebody who hasn't been able to walk for 38 years? What's involved in the muscles in the legs, for example? Did he require physical therapy? That Jesus said, now take two of these pills every day and do that for a week and then you'll be... No, it was instantaneous. Is Jesus fulfilling prophecy by doing this? Yes, as a matter of fact, the lame walk. And then you got this element here of the Sabbath. So when we look at these miracles, we need to remember that there's a larger context with each and every one of them. And this one involves healing on the Sabbath. I feel bad going quickly through some of these miracles, but we're just trying to get a flavor of why these miracles even are here, are recorded. One of the most famous of Jesus' miracles is the feeding of the 5,000. And what makes this miracle unique is that it is recorded in all four Gospels. I meant to ask this last week as a teaching question. How many parables are recorded in the Gospel of John? And the answer is none. There are zero miracles recorded in John's Gospel. Did I say miracles? You know what I meant. There are zero parables in John's Gospel. Uh-oh. People are going to walk away and say, Mark said there are no miracles in John's Gospel. There are no parables. John focuses on the signs, the seven signs. What else does he focus on? The seven I am sayings. You remember that too. The seven signs and the seven I am sayings. I am the bread of life is one of them. And what is the backdrop for Jesus saying, I am the bread of life? The feeding of the 5,000. And in John 6, what's really fascinating is all four of them, especially Mark and John, they have very different perspectives on the purpose of the message of the feeding of the 5,000. John's message, because Jesus follows this up with a sermon, and we need to turn to John 6. We need to turn to John 6. This is a turning point in Jesus' ministry. And again, I know we're going quickly. We're just kind of walking through these a little bit. But beginning of verse 22, Jesus gives what's often called the I am the bread of life discourse. Look at verse 26. Jesus answered them. He's got these people who were following him, chasing him down, and he says, truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Why were these people following Jesus? Why were they so interested in him? Because the miracle pointed to a greater spiritual significance? Food. They were following him because of the food they hoped he would provide. In the miracle, 5,000 people, 5,000 men, not counting men and women and children, women and children. It's estimated that this may have been a lot more than just 5,000, maybe 10,000. A lot of people. And Jesus fed them with truckloads of food that were brought in from Walmart. What did he feed them with? 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. He just kept multiplying it, multiplying it, multiplying it. And I've used this illustration, I guess, before. When it's supper time and you got your 2 boys, you're sitting at the table, you got your 4 kids. When do you know supper's done? Ma'am? When the food runs out. That may not be true so much in the Turner household. You know, just the two of you. You eat and say, all right, well, I'm going to save this for work. Oh, wait a minute, you're retired. And you put some of it away. In the ancient world, you knew supper was over because all the food's gone. What about in the feeding of the 5,000? There were leftovers. There were 12 baskets full of leftovers. The point is this. Jesus didn't just give them a little bit of food. He gave them an abundance of food. And then he starts telling them, I am the bread of life. Verse 31, they bring it up. They say, our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness for 40 years. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave that to them, by the way, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. Verse 35, I am the bread of life. When we think of the bread of life, when we think of bread, we're thinking of, well, bread. But this bread is closely associated with what from the Old Testament? Manna, which wasn't what we typically think of bread. It was something heavenly. It was like wafers that tasted like honey. But there's nothing on earth that's quite like manna. And Jesus says, I am what the manna was pointing to. Isn't that powerful? John 6 has now helped us to see that Jesus is reliving the wilderness experience. And he's not giving them literal bread now. He's wanting to give them spiritual bread. We don't have time to look at that. I want to think about Mark's take on this. Mark's take in Mark 8, this is after the feeding of the 5,000. And he gives this scathing rebuke of his disciples. And I've looked at this with you in previous studies. But he asked them this question. There's a series of 8 questions he asks in these verses. And here's one of them. Mark 8 verse 19. When I broke the 5,000 loaves for the 5, when I broke the loaves, the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And then he asked them about the closely related feeding of the 4,000. How many baskets did we take up? And they said, 7. And then he asked this question, do you not yet understand? What had the disciples been discussing that prodded Jesus to ask them these questions? They were in a boat, crossing the Sea of Galilee, and they were discussing with one another. We forgot the bread. They only had one loaf with them in the boat. Now, this is Mark talking about the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, and there's more to it. There's more to the story. What is Jesus basically telling these guys by asking these scathing questions and asking, too, about the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000? Yes, ma'am. He can fulfill all their needs. And they were in the boat with the true bread of life. We like to talk about loaf and bread. Loaf and bread, it's actually the same word. We only have one bread in the boat. Yeah, truer words have not been spoken. We only have one loaf. We only have one bread in the boat with us. How's that going to feed 13 guys, 12 apostles and Jesus? And Jesus says, you guys just don't get it. Do you not yet understand? That's how powerful these miracles are. It's not just the miracle in and of itself, but how these miracles point to Jesus. There's one more I want to talk about with you. If you got mad at me about the six stone water jars and the six men in the woman's life, you may not like this either. I'm still thinking about this. But in John 9, and this is all the time we're going to have for this, mud is everywhere. Mud, mud, mud. Some versions are going to say clay. But in this miracle, Jesus healed a blind man. And the way he did it is never the same. Sometimes he'll heal a blind man but just by touching him. Sometimes he'll spit on the man's eyes and apply dirt on his eyes. And so here it is here. He spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. And then he took the mud and put it on the guy's eyes and told him, go to the pool of Siloam and wash it off. Mud, mud, mud. Later in the story, in John 9, the man is being interrogated. Jesus is not there. It's just the man by himself, and he is starting to answer questions about Jesus. And as the questions are being asked, his faith is growing. We're seeing his faith grow as he's being interrogated. He's being pressured, and he's starting to reason and think, well, who is this man, Jesus? Who was this man? The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And they start asking him about all that. And then a few verses later, it says it was the Sabbath day. Before, we got eight verses into the story before we were told about the Sabbath, John 5. And he does it again in John 9. This time it takes 14 verses to get to that. It was the Sabbath day. Makes it all the more complicated when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Jesus made mud. Who else took mud and created life from mud? Who opened the eyes of the blind here? Who else took mud and fashioned it and did something with it? God. God created a whole man. Jesus created new eyes from mud, from clay. That can't be something John's pointing us to, can it? Here's something else I want you to think about. And then we're going to have to quit. I hope this has helped us a little bit to think about how powerful Jesus' miracles are and how they're teaching tools as much as they are proving who he is. But in John 9, verse 9, when the man is being interrogated, the blind man, Jesus is not there. They're asking, some people are saying, well, I think it's him. This man was blind for 38 years, or not 38, 40 years. This man's been blind since birth. But maybe it's not him. Maybe it's somebody who looks like him. And there are some people saying, no, it's him. Others said, no, it's somebody who looks like him. But what did this man keep saying? I am the man. I am the man. Actually, what the text says is simply, I am. That's it. He doesn't have the man. Our English translations helpfully try to finish the sentence. I am. Why are those two words significant? I am. Just saying those two words and nothing else. Because those are the words of God in Exodus 3 verse 14. I am that I am, that Jesus then goes on using throughout the Gospel of John. I am. By the way, when he's interrogated by Caiaphas, Jesus says, I am. I think, ma'am? Right, Exodus 3 verse 14. that incredible declaration. And then Jesus uses I am over and over again in the Gospel of John. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am seven times. And here's this man, this blind man, former blind man, now saying, I am. I am. He is a new man. He has been newly created, as it were. And he has become a little Jesus, is what I think John is trying to convey to us in this. And what would be the implication if that's true? Isn't that true? Isn't that supposed to be true of us, that we are a new creation with God? And is the baptism, immersing somebody in water and bringing them up out of water, is that a miracle? Yeah. That's no big deal. But what's going on when you put them down and bring them back up? Is that a miracle? Is that natural? Or has something truly supernatural happened? Which is more amazing? A nuclear bomb going off. Boom! Blowing up over Hiroshima. That's powerful, isn't it? Which is more amazing? That, or bringing somebody up out of the water and they're a new creation? Maybe that's something John's trying to get to us to see through the miracles. Thank you for looking at the miracles with me a little bit. Hope this is a good perspective. Next week, we're going to get back to the Gospels, and we're going to talk about Jesus' enemies. He had lots of enemies. And that's what we'll look at next week. Thank you.